It's the great Dante Read Through.
It's the great Dante Read Through, where we are reading through all of the comic strip, The Adventures of Nicolai Dante. Co-created by Robbie Morrison and Simon Fraser from the weekly science fiction anthology comic, 2000 AD.
I'm Simon Fraser.
And I'm Edie Nugent, freelance writer and Simon's wife. Join us as we swashbuckle our way through the Russian Empire of the future. Warning, there will be spoilers. We will be talking in depth about these comics, so if you haven't read them yet, listen at your own risk. To join our book club and read along with us, go to shop.2000ad.com to pick up the books in hard copy or digital.
Today we're reading The Romanov Empire, found in Prague's 1250 to 1262.
Hey, Simon.
Hey, Edie.
Hello, Irregulars, and welcome back to the Great Dante Read-Through. Today we are finishing part two of the Romanov Empire epic story, right?
Yep.
Right. So we last left what's left of the Romanov forces heading back to the Winter Palace to mount a rather desperate offensive. And Elena has headed back to the Rudenstein troops to give everyone the bad news. That kind of the big projection screens of the Tsar we saw at the end of the last episode already gave them the news, but whatever. The Tsar is coming for them.
Right.
And apparently Elena says the Tsar was burning troops in the streets and Elena could hear the Imperials laughing as she was going through. So, you know, these guys are just so nice. I don't know why anyone would start a war against them.
Who knows?
So Elena tells Dante that about 100 irregulars are left, along with a couple hundred more troops from some other regiments. And it looks like Boris and Foma, Flintlock and Spatchcock have also survived. But Dante says when he last saw Ursa, she was wounded.
Right.
And just then, Count Pyre's voice rings out across like a giant expanse of ground outside the Rudenstein gates. Like somehow his voice reaches them. Seems like kind of a long distance.
He's an alien.
Okay, sure. Alien projection.
And, and Burns makes him look very alien.
He's scary.
He's terrifying.
I gotta say, I love his take on Pyre.
Yeah, his Pyre is...
Pyre's really scary.
Suitably grotesque.
This is the perfect time in the story for it, too.
Yep.
So Pyre is denying safe passage for the Rudenstein women and children caught in the crossfire. They will suffer the same fate as the Rudenstein regiment, he says, and we see a long line of soldiers tied to posts on the hill. And then serpent wire is unleashed upon them, which is basically living razor wire. And we see Ursa up front
being
engulfed
ripped apart
by this live wire.
Yeah.
So Dante uses the huntsman to shoot her before she suffers further. And then he repeats the gesture down the line of all the tied up soldiers. Like, how many? Is this the entire 100 that Elena mentioned? Like, how many are there?
No, there's not that.
It's hard to tell. You see people.
There's about 10 on site at any given time.
In sight, but I mean, it's what it says is that, where is it? How much, like, first of all, how much ammo does the huntsman have? Is it infinite? This is my question.
Again, it's one of these things. It's a bit of a problem.
I mean, it's an alien weapon.
If you actually look into it, the huntsman is a problem.
The voiceover from Maria Beria's book says that he was firing for what seemed like an eternity. So it's definitely more than 10.
Right.
Right? I don't know how many.
So basically, he executes his own regiment.
He executes his own regiment so that they don't die horribly.
Rather than shoot the guys using the razor wire or somehow disable the razor wire, which he could have done, but no, he didn't do that. He just killed all his regiment.
I think it was happening too quickly.
You reckon?
I don't know.
He's got time to shoot everybody, but
he does. It does. That would take time, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Listen, it's okay.
Nah.
Fair enough. So then Dante, it's horrible though. It's a horrible scene.
Yeah.
It's horrible to see Ursa suffer this way at all. And it's good and that he manages
empathy. Burns has got great empathy for Ursa, obviously.
Yeah, she looks wonderful as she dies.
Very peaceful.
Yeah. And then Dante stands alone on the ramparts for a while and stares out at the crucified forms of his men and women. Thank you very much. Just says men. Mm-hmm. Until darkness fell. And that's according to Maria Beria in Hero of the Romanovs.
Yeah.
Very dark, sad
scene. Super heroic there, Dante.
Yeah. Back at the governor's mansion at Rudenstein, Andreas tends to a topless Elena's wounds in a large bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
They talk and Andreas bares his soul while Elena bears her back.
Bears her bod.
I actually thought this was interesting, kind of what he tells her here, sort of playing against type. He says, "Everything I stand for is a joke. Andreas the playboy, Andreas the hellraiser, Andreas the great lover. All I am is tabloid fodder. A series of ever more embarrassing, risque yarns. I haven't done one worthwhile thing in my entire life until now."
Maybe. This is like Andreas's like fallback position. If cheesy seduction doesn't work, then he'll fall back.
Look at my honesty. Sad boy heart.
Yeah, I am emo and I am sad.
I do believe him here, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Also, he's tending to her wounds in a way that is like, you know, I don't know. There's something
emotional wounds too.
Well, yeah, but I mean, there's just something really like caring and delicate about doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? He gives her the chance to say that she wants it. Right.
Right.
He's not. I mean, you can make a case here that they're sort of coupling during a time where mm-hmm. she's really traumatized and can she really like mm-hmm. be in the best place to consent to stuff, right? But I mean, they're both kind of in this terrible war together is the thing.
I would have done this whole episode, this couple, because I think that's the most interesting scene.
It really is. I would have loved to have more Elena and Andreas.
That story, that narrative of those two characters finding each other is fascinating, and I'd love that, but it's too... I mean, we've got 6 pages a week, so yeah.
Well, and I love that she discloses here, Elena discloses here that it took everything she had to reject the Tsar and not spit on him and say, "I'm not joining your regiment."
Mm-hmm.
"Standing before him was the first time I've ever known fear, and it still hasn't left me."
Mm-hmm.
And then she says that she's having a fear of not having lived, right? And that they put a sword in her hand when she was 5 years old.
Right.
And she says she knows everything about death and nothing about life. And so he then kisses Andreas her back.
Then volunteers to teach her about
life. Yes, he gives her a little kiss on her back of her neck, which she seems to like. Yeah. And then... Okay. They fall into bed together.
Fair enough.
You know, as one does.
As one does.
As one does. So, sometime later, the siege of the Winter Palace and the Battle of Rudenstein begin, which are apparently the final conflicts of the war. So it's all going to be decided here, folks.
Yeah.
Raven wings strafe the palace, Romanova eagles respond, and Imperial dreadnoughts come to play with troops at the ready.
Mm-hmm.
The 33rd Imperial Artillery Division is bombarding Rudenstein, which is already in pretty bad shape.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they're bombarding, but yeah.
Just to prove a point. So Dante storms into Elena's room shouting, "To arms!" and discovers her in Andreas's arms.
Turn up for the books, that one. Normally it's the other way
around. Yeah, normally it's the other way around. And I like how calm they are when he runs in, and he's just clearly very jealous that he's not getting to be in bed with anyone. Mm-hmm. So then on the battlefield, Jenna is trying to order a ceasefire on Rudenstein, but the Tsar has apparently already put Count Pyre in charge, and he is not having any of it.
No.
Right? Dante is going to watch those women and children die while Pyre is in charge.
Right.
Okay?
Pyre is a monster.
He's really a monster at this point. Back at the Winter Palace, the warlord is just, like, pulse-frying everyone, left, right, and center. And the Imperial army is storming the palace as the security, the Winter Palace, as the security has apparently been breached.
It looks like these metal balloons you get at Party City. Sorry.
Mylar.
Yeah.
Mylar balloons. So the Imperial army is then storming the Winter Palace and security has been breached. That's the only way they could have gotten in. And Arkady is incredulous, as only a Romanov family member could have disabled the security.
Mm-hmm.
That will come into play in a little bit.
Indeed.
Back at the ruining of Rudenstein, Dante watches helplessly as Boris and Foma get shot by a Raven Corps soldier.
Okay.
Holding a dead Foma in his lap, Boris gets badass and pulls out a grenade all like, you know, here's a present from Matilda, you know, and strikes a huge blow, blowing himself up and blowing the giant werewolf robots that make up a large part of the Imperial assault on Rudenstein, giving them a fighting chance.
Wacky design again, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but very big moment.
Indeed.
And they sort of have a voiceover about how this guy was like a thief, cutthroat, and God knows what else, terrible person, and he became sort of heroic in his final final stand. Okay. Yes. Back at the Winter Palace.
It would have been more interesting if they'd actually tried to stab Dante in the back and never, ever, never, ever became heroic. Just like constantly running away, like stabbing other officers. complete disaster. Like, why? What? Oh, yeah. Okay. Because we're bad people.
Yes. So back at the Winter Palace, we're jumping back and forth here a lot. The warlord engages with Victor and electrocutes his face, it looks like, before pitching him out the window from on high.
Mm-hmm.
But he's an eagle. Like, Victor is an eagle and no body, no death. For Victor, as far as I'm concerned. We just see him flying through the air, and I'm like, this dude can fly.
Yeah.
Okay?
Terrifying.
I mean, I know he just electrocuted his face. I mean, you could make the argument that he, like, somehow fried his crest, but it's in his face. He's not pushing him on his on where the crest would be, so.
There's some ambiguity about how you kill someone with a weapon's crest.
Because yes.
On the one hand, some of them seem very, very hard to kill. Dante, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And other ones seem to, like, die very quickly, and I'm like, wait, why? What? So I suppose they're supposed to have some kind of regenerative ability anyway.
Right.
So that's presumably what Victor has.
So the Imperials arrive at Lulu's quarters just as she's having a liquid latex bath.
As she does.
And tells the she tells the delighted regiment that she'll come willingly after her latex suit is finished. The Winter Palace is imploding. We see outside. It's imploding from multiple points. So Daddy Dimitri then has a heart-to-heart with Arkady. Who he apologizes to for letting Dante keep his crest and tells him he loves him and kisses him. So you were saying we never see him be a human. This is the most human we ever see Dimitri.
I'm not sure even that works.
It's well,
creepy and
disgusting. It is creepy. It is totally creepy. And then he does something creepy off camera, right? We see a couple panels.
Yeah.
And I am like, is he giving Arkady his crest? Is that what's happening here? I feel like one of our listeners told us about this by accident, like some episodes ago.
Don't spoil it for her. She gets really upset.
I do. I get mad. But it took me a minute because I didn't know what was going on because it almost looks like gross. Like he's pushing Arkady's head down somewhere it shouldn't go. Like the panel.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean though? Look at
it. You made it even worse.
I know. I did make it worse. But like, look at the panels. This is what I thought at first. But then I realized that we see the crest sort of fading off of his shoulder as he's doing it, right? And we have already established that, like, crests can do weird things and they can cloak themselves. And so, okay.
Dimitri's crest is the super crest.
It's the super one.
It's the one that dominates all the other crests.
Yes,
it's
the master crest.
We don't know about
it. So anyway, the Tsar shows up with his warlord to ruin this touching father-son snuggle fest and tells Dimitri to surrender. And Dimitri is like, surrender this, and shoots himself in the head. And his blood splatters all over the terrified Arkady. So like, oh my God, Dimitri is dead.
Yeah.
We're pretty sure.
At this point,
if he gave his crest to Arkady like I just saw, then that dude's dead. He's not going to survive a headshot. He's splattered. He's laying on the floor with blood splattered out of his head. It looks bad.
Yep.
This looks like the end.
Yep.
And Arkady is having his like Lion King moment. He's like leaning over Dad, and it's like you actually feel bad for him. Isn't Arkady like 17 or something now? He's young.
Yeah, I would have made him look a little less sneery and evil here and more shocked. But
well, we're about to get there. I just wanted to establish Arkady is like 17,
he's a
right?
Because
we met him when he was like 15. And it's been like 2 or 3 years. Yeah, so I'm just like, Jesus, this kid, like, I don't know why, but I feel bad for him.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then the Tsar is like, you'll be my ward, Arkady.
Mm-hmm.
And Arkady doesn't look at all ready to exact revenge. Like, not even a little bit, right? He looks totally chill. Like, this seems like a really good decision, Tsar. Like, bring him into the fold. Because as you're saying, he looks definitely sneery.
Mm-hmm.
So we cut back to the battle from this scene, and we have a voiceover telling us that Rudenstein fell under the third assault, again, according to Tsar Wars and Georgi Lukasevich.
Yeah.
A tide of blood flooded the city as Dante tried and failed to fight everyone from within the governor's mansion, where the civilian population is sort of amassed, and but they were like helpless against the imperial forces. So Pyre must be feeling pretty good right now. His plan is working out.
Yeah.
In a horrifying technicolor here. And an imperial officer instructs a subordinate to bring the surviving women to the imperial brothels so they can be of use. And we know what happens when anybody says that sort of thing in this comic.
Yes.
Slash. Right? He's cut down by a bio blade. But wait, it's not Dante. It's Andreas being all heroic and shit. He and Elena and Dante fight the Imperials back from the surviving women and children. And then wham, an Imperial gunner just blasts Andreas's entire torso to bits.
Yeah, again, we come back to like, how do you kill these guys? Suddenly Andreas is like killed with some random gunfire.
Well, it's a big gun.
Is it?
You see these guns here? It's a big, like, tower gun.
Yeah, but then again, he's lying there on the ground, like, giving his final speech. He like, is. If he was shot to death with artillery, he'd be, like, well, a million tiny pieces.
But maybe that's why, is that he's got a crest, so this doesn't blast him into a million pieces, and he has time to say goodbye, because he's super tough.
I don't know.
Whatever. Don't ruin his death scene. Okay. Right. Pyre is leading the assault, of course, and Dante tries to take him out, but the huntsman misses. Like, can it even miss? I thought the huntsman could not miss, but it misses Pyre.
It misses Pyre.
Because reasons.
I tell you how to draw this.
Yeah.
I'd have drawn it like Andreas's head or bits of his head. Yeah, something. System, like lying in a pile of garbage, and it'd be like,
That's terrible.
Do his last scene like that.
Oof, that's intense.
Because the crest will keep him alive for that
time,
but no more.
Like the brain that would not die.
Right, because I think this whole kind of like dying in the arms of your
lover. All right, well, like, listen. All right. Yeah. So, meanwhile, Elena lies to Andreas and tells him that the women and children are safe. And they share a touching scene as he chokes on his own blood.
Yeah.
And he tells Elena that he would have loved her. And Dante interrupts them again.
Yep.
And tells Andreas that he lost their bet, and Andreas asks to die with a kiss on his lips. So Dante kisses him, which should come off as a cheap gag. For some reason, I really like it. I don't know why. I really love this.
It's funny.
And it works. Kind of love the three of them as well. Like, there's something going on here that I like, and I wish I saw more of.
There's a lot of love in that room.
Yeah, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Anyways, he says, I meant the girl, Kolya. And there's something just really heartbreaking about him still being funny in this moment and still calling Dante Kolya. Like,
yeah,
it really, this got to me. This actually got to me. And so Elena kisses him as he dies in her arms.
As a mentor figure, he has to die. That's how mentors go in stories. So it's like, it is important, his death. And it's good. I think it's a good.
But
it's a good
I don't death. Know how to feel here, honestly, because I'm wondering, like, what evil have we seen from Andreas? Like, am I forgetting about?
Oh God! I mean, he's killed thousands of people. Right?
Because I care about him now, and that feels weird. I don't know what's going on.
There's no innocence in this game.
I don't know what's happening. So Pyre is giggling over Andreas's death. So he and Dante have their face off, and they battle. And Pyre does that cool making a hole in the center of his body thing when Dante tries to shove a bio blade into him. And Pyre invokes his dead lover, who I believe was Morales. Thank you. And he shapeshifts into a giant mantis with like too many legs and makes to crunch Dante between his huge mandibles. When the crest reminds Dante he has bio blades, which he seems to forget a lot, by the way. Yeah. And so Dante slashes himself free. And Pyre's like all like eating Dante's blood and talking about how good it tastes. He's really laughing. Monstrous.
He's cackling baddie.
Yes. And then he shapeshifts into the dragon from like the end of Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah.
And he eats Dante. And so then Dante's in his stomach with the acids that are going to, like, dissolve him.
Yeah,
but, of course, this gives Dante the ability to slash his way out of the beast's stomach, which seems to kill him. Meanwhile, Flintlock and Spatchcock appear to be the last irregulars left other than Elena. But they're stuck in a literal minefield, so who knows how long they'll be standing. I thought this was kind of a weird little aside.
Yeah, I mean, the ending is basically the Italian job. All right, don't panic. I've got an idea. And that's it. It's definitely an Italian job riff here.
Yeah.
So we know we're going to see them again.
Yeah.
But, you know,
this is them in the war. We've got a lot of kind of quiet beats happening here. Like the entire next page, there's no dialogue. You know, we just sort of see Dante walking away from this wreckage. I don't know where Elena is. I assume he's left her with with the body of Andreas. And he's kind of walking away, and he discovers this standard in the smoking ruins of Rudenstein.
Symbolically smashing the standard.
And smashes it to bits, because we need more metaphor.
Yep.
But we see out of the corner, we see somebody pulling a gun from their hip. And, of course, it is Jenna.
Hey.
She pulls a gun on Dante.
The ex. Just what you want to see at the lowest point.
Yes. Who she arrests in the name of the Tsar. As Captain Romanov, she says, "Captain Romanov, I arrest you in the name of the Tsar." And Dante is like, "Dante, I'm Nikolai Dante." So he's taking the Dante back now. What do we think about this?
Again, to my earlier point about always a subtext, it's a little bit too triumphant. I'm like, nah, it needs to be a bit more pain in his eyes there.
Yeah.
To my mind.
Yeah.
Especially facing off against the ex, and he's just clawed his way out of a
dragon's stomach. Yeah, he's kind of smiling in a way that I wouldn't have him smile.
Yeah, it's a little bit too smug.
Yeah.
If there's some sort of triumph there, it's ironic.
Mm-hmm.
He's like feeling it, you know?
Yeah.
He's trying to work out who he is again. Yeah. As he does periodically. That's the thing of it, Dante does. He periodically tries to work out who the hell he is in context of their circumstances around him.
Yeah.
So yeah, great. I mean, great piece of artwork, no question. Yeah.
I mean, but, I love the ruins of Rudenstein behind him, and they're like crosses, like the cross beams from the busted up homes or buildings, and it looks like crosses coming out of the background there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad I didn't have to draw it, but at the same time, wish I could have drawn it. anyway.
And then we're back at the Winter Palace.
Winter Palace looking beat up.
Really beat up. And the Tsar is talking to Jocasta.
Again, Burns does Jocasta very well. Female characters, by and large, Burns does very, very well.
Yes.
And the Tsar, he does very well. The Tsar is a very deliberately strong design. I mean, I don't think you can really do much with the Tsar except, like, lean into the sort of slab-like, impassive granite face.
And, you know, I want to take a minute to, like, dial it back to, like, rewind, because it's going to become important in a couple of moments to the story. And I can't remember now which book it was in. I really should have looked this up. Normally I do before we record, where we learn about the backstory between Jocasta and Dimitri and the Tsar.
They meet an archangel and have that little powwow before the
war. Right. Yeah. And they talk about when they were young and what happened when they were all wards. And I really love that story. Like, I love that backstory for this.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of sad that we're like at this point where it almost feels like we're not going to get any of that anymore. Like that was it. I really liked it. I really liked it. I feel like it really gives this whole battle like some interesting underpinnings that really needed to be there. I almost wish we knew that longer ago.
Yeah. Well, you know, clearly clearly
I kind of wish that had been revealed before the battle. And maybe we got more of it as we got into the battle, but I would have liked the seeds of that being there, because I feel like, you know, we were talking a lot about how the war turned me off and I jumped off of this book when we were kind of reading into the war. I feel like if I'd known more of that backstory up front, it would have had me a little bit more, because I would understand they wouldn't just be these sort of faceless monsters battling it out for like supremacy and territory. Like there's history here. There's this idea that they were these downtrodden individuals who were manipulated and they want to make a better future, you know?
Yeah, I think we got
But that. Not before the war started. Not before it started, we didn't.
Yeah. I mean,
not at all.
Okay.
I mean, not even a little bit. No, there was not even a hint of it. So I'm just saying. Anyway, okay. I like it a lot.
Yeah.
I
mean, I do like the older couple who have, like, history. That adds a lot to it.
Absolutely.
And it frankly adds a lot to the Tsar.
Yeah.
And, again, I would have liked to have seen from Dimitri is that kind of, you know, the pudgy little nerd boy he's portrayed, which I drew him as back in the day when he was young. He's, like, obviously the one who's, like, not
the
chosen.
The incel.
Not the one chosen first for a football team, but the guy who's kind of, like, at the end of the line. But, you know, burning resentment in his eyes.
Oh, yeah. I would have loved a sort of, what do you call it, like Dr. Octopus backstory for Dimitri, where we sort of learn why he's like so frustrated. And, you know, before his family was murdered, right? Like that's supposed to be like one of his big motivators is like, we watch his feelings sort of die as his family is murdered. But I feel like there has to be more leading up to that for that to make sense to me. So I would like to see some of that.
Kind of like a bit of a blank.
Yeah.
He's just this sort of sneering evil. And he's never really given much of a reason for doing anything other than like frustration.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, the Tsar tells Jocasta that he could use her as a member of his council. So he sort of invites her to stay. The Tsar is just trying to recruit all the ladies from from Dimitri's side.
You have to respect his pragmatism.
He's
got an eye for talent.
He does.
Just like, no, you come to my side. And no hard feelings. You know, we've had this horrible war and I've killed half your children, but, you know, no hard feelings.
Yeah. And she's like, no, I hate you because of all those innocent people you totally didn't have to kill, but like did anyway.
Yeah.
And she's really badass here. She's like, I'll be the one thing you can't conquer.
There you go.
Which I really like. I won't lie. I really like
Jocasta. She's one of the best characters.
Totally like Jocasta.
She's one of the best
characters. I wish we had more Jocasta. Okay, so we need more Elena and Andreas, and we need more Jocasta.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think there's some great female characters in this.
Yes.
And
she's so interesting. And how she loves Dante and everything. Like, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
I want to know what the heck she sees in him, you know?
Potential.
Yeah. What is it? I want to hear her talk about it more. Anyway. Mm-hmm. So the Tsar basically bids her farewell and commands his warlord to kill her. Mm-hmm. Like, do what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And then the warlord removes his helmet and says, like, I could never hurt you, mommy.
Mm-hmm.
And it is...
Superman.
Constantine. He does look a little super... Oh my God, he really does look like Superman there. He's got the little curly Q on his head.
I know.
But it's Constantine. Yes, what the heck?
That's what's happening.
So, like, remember in the episode before, a couple episodes ago, I was saying that I thought we were going to have the reveal during that backstory that Constantine is the Tsar's son. Mm-hmm. That Jocasta got pregnant with him because he was so much older than his siblings and they kind of look similar. And, you know, well, I
don't know. Constantine's not the oldest son. The oldest son is Valentin, the crazy one.
Oh, my God. I forgot about Valentin entirely.
Another
oh, my God.
Guy
oh, my God. That again, but again, even though we had the twins die and we had Valentin die, remember that when... Nastasia dies, it is the first time that the siblings have confronted their mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Those three other people did not count.
We don't talk about that.
I totally forgot about Valentin. Oh my God.
Yeah.
He was like the favorite.
Well, he was the oldest one. He was the eldest one who got the first crest. So he had an experimental crest which broke
his little mind.
Yeah.
I completely forgot about
him. So Constantine is the second one. I'm not sure if he's the second or the third. Maybe Lulu's older. I'm not sure.
Anyway, oh, that's interesting.
Constantine was the
favorite. Well, that blows my whole theory out of the water. Blows it all out of the water.
Yep.
But he definitely got in bed with the Tsar, even if he isn't his son, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this kind of weird convoluted thing where... The Tsar apparently, like, showed him proof that the Tsar and Jocasta had a thing back in the day, and so Constantine decided to fight for him.
Constantine is desperately looking for a daddy who'll love
him. Am I saying this wrong? It's Constantine, not Constantine?
I always pronounce it Constantine. Like Constantine, I suppose, works too. I don't know.
I've been saying Constantine.
Yeah, Constantine. I don't know. Whatever.
Anyway, guy.
Him, whatever he's called. Anyway, he's good. This guy's got daddy issues.
Clearly.
He's looking for someone to love him.
Yeah.
If it's not his mommy, then he'll look for a daddy wherever he can find one.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's an odd turn because he talks about how they should have been children of the Tsar, though, like, of course, he wouldn't have existed if they were children of the Tsar. Like, he wouldn't be him. But Constantine does not seem big on brains. So,
no, he's not.
He's brute force. But because Dimitri is so mean, he's like, screw this. I'll enlist with the enemy and it's good for you, Mom.
I don't like my daddy. I want a different daddy.
I want the winning daddy.
Yeah.
I'll order the winning daddy, please.
That's right.
Yeah. And he talks about, and I remember this popped up. So first of all, I was like, what? When this happened, I was not even thinking that there was a human inside that robot. Mm-hmm, like, maybe I was supposed to think there was, but I did not think that.
Yeah.
So that was, like, a big reveal for me.
Mm-hmm.
But he talks about how his body was saved from the Potemkin, which, if you flip back, exploded like a nuke. Like, yeah. It blew up fast and huge. And was
stabbed first with a weapon.
Stabbed
first.
Through with a bio blade. Yeah. So, I have no idea how there was anything left of him to save. Like, I would buy that if that ship crashed normally, mm-hmm. that Constantine, because he has the weapons crest and he's tough, that, like, a stab through the heart, like, didn't do it for whatever right. reason. But the way that thing blew up, I mm-hmm. mean, it was huge.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what's going on there.
It's like, how do you kill these people?
I don't know.
It seems rather arbitrary.
Anyway, he's back.
Anyway.
So we lost two siblings.
Yes.
Right? We're assuming Andreas is mm-hmm. dead. We saw him kind of die. Right. And Anastasia is dead. Anastasia, so we've got one back
definitely
now.
Definitely dead, yeah.
We've got Constantine's back.
Right.
Back in the mix.
Yeah, we've got another one.
And Jocasta is, of course, horrified. He's like, I did it for you, mother. And she's like, I have no son. Except for the other ones that are still alive.
Yes, exactly. she does have Victor still alive.
I mean, they're talking about Victor, Arcady. They're talking about Victor like he's dead, but I do not buy it at all. Yeah, you do not throw the guy who has wings off a tower and no body and convince me that he's dead.
No body, no death. Yeah.
So back at Rudenstein, Jenna and Dante are aboard her ship, and she's like basically going to take him back to the Tsar.
Mm-hmm.
And they have like this whole little conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Your father threatened to eat me once. I don't remember that at all. Do you remember that?
Something.
You know, and then she's like, first time I ever saw your face, none of the deaths my dad designed for you were painful enough. And he's like, the first time I saw you, I wanted to take you into my arms and make love to you.
Mm.
And I'm like, that was not what you were thinking, Dante. That was, like, that may have been your end result, but that's not how you were thinking about it.
I mean, they're trying to play this.
Sounds very romantic, but
flirtation.
Anyways,
but quite.
And he says he thinks about their night in the Baltic every day, which I do believe.
Sure.
I do believe that he thinks about that marathon sex session.
Yeah.
And he basically says, like, what happened to us, Jenna? And she's like, your family murdered my sister, and then you put a blade in me, and I put a bullet in you. Like, good summary.
Yes. Yeah, this is the stuff I really want to draw.
The acting stuff. And he says, I should have killed you.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I could have killed you. Why didn't you? And then they make out.
Ish. Well, I don't know. She kind of like fakes him out. And
oh, like you don't think they actually kiss? Then she like pulls away?
No, I think she kind of pulls away.
Oh.
I think she's kind of like.
Oh, that's rough.
Yeah, blue balls.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's rough.
Yeah.
Oh, that's rough. Okay. And then she dumps him in the ashes of Rudenstein, and she mm-hmm. basically says here, disappear, Nikolai. Get as far off-world as you can. There's a big empire out there, even big enough to swallow someone like you. I want you to die here today. Do you understand? I want you to make sure we never see each other again, because it would kill us if we did. I want you to make sure the name Nikolai Dante is never heard of again.
Good.
And he looks emo.
Yeah.
So I guess he's Quentin now. Quentin again. Here comes Quentin.
Quentin Dorkwood.
Quentin comes forth.
Oh, goodness. I drew the next one, didn't I?
Yeah. Yep. Anyway. I'm actually looking at this now, and I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, we probably should have covered the Gentleman Thief at the end of this.
You want how much time have we got?
Yeah, we got like 31 minutes.
We'd have to read it. Okay, so now we're reading Return of the Gentleman Thief, found in Progs 2002, and 1273 to 1274.
Okay. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Edie. We're back again.
We're back again. Back again a few seconds later.
We went away and read it and wrote it all up, and then come back about a week later.
They don't have to know that.
They don't know there's been a time in between. Anyway.
So, hello again, regulars. Welcome to the second half of our episode here.
Yes.
The second half of the Romanov Empire just didn't quite fill an episode, so we figured we'd throw some Gentleman Thief in. It's also kind of sad, the end of Romanov Empire, yeah. So let's try and have a little fun.
Yes.
Gentleman Thief, who wrote it, who drew it, who lettered it?
Okay, it's a little complicated. It's written, of course, by Robbie Morrison, as always. It's drawn by me. Colors. So this time we've got Alison Kirkpatrick, my old collaborator, and Chris Blythe, and we'll talk about this as we go in, because this is a little bit of a mess, and it's
just a bit of a jarring
transition. It's not right.
Chris Blythe did the colors on Fiends, right?
He did, yes. Yeah. Chris is, no, I'm not, I'm, we'll talk about it as we go, and I'll point out examples. Letters are by Annie Parkhouse.
Yay, Annie.
Yep.
Okay, so if you wanna grab mm-hmm. this here.
Yeah.
Open it up there, sir.
Open it up there. Okay,
So New Year. Yeah. We are in 2671. That feels really fast to me. Like, I feel like we just got to 2670, and now it's 2671.
I think we were at Christmas 2670.
Yeah, but it was a few episodes ago, dude. I remember saying it.
Time is elastic.
All right.
Lunchtime doubly so.
We have a great splash page by you. We see an Imperial Golden Cruiser sailing over the streets of one of the cities of the Empire here.
So this is a tonal shift. I spent a bit of time on this page, and a tonal shift. I wanted to try and emphasize an architectural shift. So I'm moving more towards Art Deco now, because Art Deco is traditionally the architecture of totalitarianism.
Why?
Because it was very popular in the 1920s, and a big advocate for Art Deco and modernist was Albert Speer, who was architect to Adolf Hitler.
Art Deco. This is really upsetting.
A lot of the Art Deco at that time was used for monumental and slightly oppressive buildings, frankly.
Oh my God.
Because it was kind of a development of the Roman style into the kind of modern age. So it's that kind of period of oppressive Art Deco. So it looks cool, it's also...
I'm like horrified. I love Art Deco.
Yeah.
What does that say about me?
Nothing.
I don't know.
You like stylish things?
Oh, my God.
It's very stylish. It's just, it has an association. Anyway.
Hugo Boss stylish.
Right. So we got Alison Kirkpatrick back in. Alison colored the first, first Dante was colored by me. Then Alison picked it up in the early days of coloring Dante. Now, Alison has been my old friend for a long time. She's my universal collaborator. We joke about it because she used to letter for me, too. She lettered Lux and Albie, Sign On and Save the Universe, my first book. And then she agreed to color Dante when I was having trouble coloring it myself. And then she came and she quit for a while because she was having babies. And those babies those babies are now all grown up. But back then, she was like, the kids were slightly older, so she had more time. So she said she would step in and color this bit for me. Right. It's not working out very well. Mm-hmm. She was, I think, using digital for the first time. She has never really done it before. It's a bit mushy.
I was just going to say it's a little muddy in places.
It's at the same time, it's kind of a little bit garish, but it's also a little bit muddy.
Yeah.
It's a little bit uncontrolled. It doesn't really work with the line work very well.
I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that even though I definitely had those feelings as well, I think because of kind of the sadness of this story,
right,
it sort of works because it's sort of ashy and corpses are everywhere.
Well, here's the thing. Like, Alison's actually quite a good storyteller. She's a good artist in her own right. So she is actually going for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate what she's trying to do. It just isn't really working for me. And this is kind of where I start rethinking how the artwork goes. And you will see as it develops in the next few episodes of things where it eventually ends up and where, the last sort of third of Dante I'm very, very happy with in terms of artwork because I had much more control over it. But this is kind of where I decided to do that because I realized that I'm not getting what I want from other colorists, but I have to kind of work out a way of making that because I can't do everything myself. Anyway,
okay.
So we've got Alison here. And then Chris Blythe picks it up later on in the episodes.
Okay, so just to follow the storyline, we've got an Imperial Golden Cruiser that's over the streets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Vlad the Conqueror is celebrating his victory over the Romanovs with celebrations throughout the Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have this great page. The levels of the cities and the detail in here that you've done is really, really incredible. And we have an inset panel of Jenna looking stern and conflicted.
And old.
I don't think she looks old. She just looks drawn.
She looks aged.
She looks drawn to
me. The war has been hard on her.
Right. She's had a tough ride.
I want it to be obvious that she's not having a fun time.
Yes, that's very obvious. So meanwhile, as the Tsar is on his like multi-city tour, purge squads are apparently murdering those who betrayed Vlad.
Mm-hmm.
So just enemy soldiers and sympathizers, I guess.
Yeah.
Men and women, and let's be honest, probably children, are getting slaughtered by Ravenkor in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And buildings of the houses who supported the Romanovs are being burned and rebuilt, it says. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming rebuilt to house families that were loyal to the Tsar.
Right. Yeah.
And we see a Ravenkor standing with an arm cannon on a pile of skulls.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a quote here that says, "The Tsar's tyranny knew no limits."
Mm-hmm.
This sure feels like a gentleman thief story, huh?
Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, the Raven Corps. Yikes. This is my Raven Corps again, thank God.
Yes, with the right Raven on there.
I'm not 100%. I mean, there's some dodgy drawing coming up. It doesn't. The coloring doesn't help, but the drawing underneath isn't great.
Well, basically, it talks about the sort of slightly jarring transition here is that the Empire started to rebuild itself, and the hardships of war have forced some into a life of vice and crime. Right. And we see a little panel of two men swindling a few would-be Johns out of their money.
Well, that's
dressing
to be,
one up as a woman.
That's supposed to be Spatchcock and Flintlock, by the way.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
The two guys that...
That's the two swindlers.
Oh, the two swindlers. Yeah,
yeah. But because they're not really my characters, I hadn't drawn them much up to that point.
Oh.
It's not immediately obvious. Because
Easter eggs.
Anyway.
I love it. Okay. Yeah. They talk about the frozen mausoleum of the Winter Palace. And we have another Simon Fraser composite page where we have... Dimitri pointing the gun to his head from last episode. And is this Andreas here that's kind of screaming?
That's
with
Andreas'
some
head
teeth?
On a spike.
Oh my God. Oh my God, I didn't realize.
His head on a spike.
Oh my God, I didn't realize that. Oh my God. And that's why his teeth are knocked out.
Right, because his head's been kicked around like a football.
Oh my God. And there's like a bird with a scrap of Andreas in its mouth. Listen, I don't normally swear on this podcast because I don't like to swear and like have to mark it explicit, but like fuck off with Victor being dead. I'm sorry. That's ridiculous. He can fly. He got slightly tussled by his... Why?
Okay. Hold that thought.
Okay.
Just hold that thought.
Because this is bullshit is all I'm saying.
Hold that thought.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
Don't get too excited.
Fine.
About this.
Good. Okay. Anyway. Okay. I immediately called bullshit.
Yeah, it's very muddy here. I'm not
okay. It is muddy, my dear, but it's okay.
Yeah,
we're all right. Anyway. We're all right. Listen, I see what you're going for because you're kind of doing the Alison Kirkpatrick thing too. It's like you're both doing the same thing. You're both kind of like this sort of heavy weighted art is coming through to sort of communicate the colorlessness, the lifelessness, and the ash, and the soot, and the blood, and the death.
The thing is that at this point, I'm doing a relatively crisp, sharp line, but the coloring is mush, and that doesn't really sink well. You need to be doing much sharper coloring to go with the line work. And this is a problem I'm going to come up with time and time again here, is that the coloring is fighting with the line work. And you'll see this later as well even with Gary's stuff later on too. It's like the coloring and the line work aren't really getting on very well. And that's where we start to explore different options later on.
Anyway. Right. Okay.
I quite like this page here, the big splash page with Dante in the bar, though.
We're getting there. And I just wanted to say that Lulu's like strolling through.
Yeah.
Just killing people with her little cybernetic creatures. Because Lulu's going to Lulu.
With a flourish.
No matter what's going on. Exactly, with a flourish. Mm-hmm. Even though the last time we saw her, she was being like captured by the Tsar's soldiers covered in latex.
Yep.
So I guess this is her busting out of being captured.
Yeah. I mean, that's a prison door.
Okay, so she's busting out.
Prison door.
But she's not in her latex. I guess it's just green randomly.
Whatever she's wearing.
Wasn't green last.
Who knows?
Anyway, they talk about how the Romanov crest becomes the mark of the damned, and only one name was said with greater loathing than Romanov, which is...
The name's Dante, Nikolai Dante, and I can out-drink, out-fight, out-wit, out-love any man, woman, or alien in the Empire.
And I'm going to swear again, because it's not out-love, it's out-fuck. Out-love.
You're not allowed to say fuck.
Well, I'm saying it now.
Okay. Well, you're not allowed
out-love
to say
out-love really bothers me. It's
does
just
that,
like,
does that bother
ugh.
You again? Okay.
It's
anyway.
Just because it's so, like, obviously a fig leaf. It's like, nobody says that. Nobody says out love.
Hmm.
Anyways. And he's certainly not loving. That's not what Dante is doing here. But
I like
anyway.
The color here. This color, this page is good because she's done this kind of orange wash over the whole page. And then sort of gone into low lights and blocks of color. That works.
Yeah, this looks really good.
That works very well. The
Dante Dante's standing in the center of a bar full of ne'er-do-wells announcing himself.
Indeed.
And it's got kind of a sort of golden hour light almost to it, but a little bit scuzzier.
Yeah. And she's got a CRISPR line to it, and it's like blocks of color, which is fine. That's perfect.
So Dante's basically in this bar bragging that no one's going to collect the $700 billion bounty on his head.
Right.
quite a lot of money.
This doesn't make any sense. It's like, come on. 10 of them are going to get together and go, we're going to just take this guy down. We're going to reduce him to the constituent parts and then deliver him to the czar.
Well, this makes him a target. So
of course, death
some wish. Guy is trying to knife Dante from behind, but Dante asks for two bottles of vodka and takes one of the two and smashes it into the face of the guy coming up behind him, which I like that he asked for two because it's like one to drink and one to smash with.
Mm-hmm.
And then he runs into an old friend, Tanya Tannhauser, who I had to ask you, I'm like, did we meet this broad before?
No,
we did not meet this broad before.
From Dante's
but they're
past.
They're old friends, so we've not met her, but he has met her. And apparently Dante liked to sneak into Tanya's bed when the former owner of this bar, Big Bartok, wasn't around. And apparently he ended up dying of a, air quotes, heart attack in Tanya's arms. So now Tanya's running the place.
Well, good for Tanya.
Yeah, Tanya's doing it for herself.
Mm-hmm.
And the old friends are chatting and flirting as various bar patrons try to kill Dante.
Right.
So he, at one point, picks up Tanya and plops her up on a bar table, like a high table, before telling her to spread her legs. So
there's no way she's going to be able to spread her legs with that skirt on. That skirt does not allow any spreadage.
It's future fabric.
When
your legs are together, it fits tight, but then when you need to move, it stretches. It's future space fabric.
Okay.
You know.
So there's no axe proof.
Well, spread her legs so that he can jump away from her at the last moment before an axe meant for him lands between her legs. And I'm just saying, like, Tanya should, like, throw him out now. Like, he ruined her dress.
True.
And like, women may not have dangly bits down there, but I feel like the writing here is like, oh, women don't have a wiener, so it's okay for a giant axe to come between their legs and they just like won't flinch. Excuse me. That is horrifying and disturbing. Like, yikes. Anyways, that really bothered me. I was like, ugh. Like, I crossed my legs reading it.
Just as a reference point here, the bar is in a cage. This is my reference point for, like, dodgy bars. It's like, if the barman has to be in a cage, this is a dodgy effing bar. And I saw this when I lived in Tanzania. It's like the bar across the road from me, where the barman was in a cage.
Oh, my God.
A welded steel cage. And I'm like, holy crap, how dodgy is this bar?
Wow.
And I was told how dodgy it was. And I'm like, oh, my goodness.
I'm
not going back there.
That sounds intimidating.
Yeah.
So the remaining patrons kind of all gather together to all try and kill Dante.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrenches the axe from the table by Tanya's crotch and throws it at a well-placed chandelier overhead that comes crashing down upon all the guys still trying to kill him.
Yep.
And I just want to know, I just want to know here, where did Tanya's skirt go? Can you explain it to me?
It doesn't
get torn off because it gets a cut through the front of it. And you can see here that it's separated into two pieces. She still has a waistband around her waist somewhere.
Okay.
So did she just like cut through and rip it off and we just didn't see that? Because like, where is it? It's vanished. I'm just saying.
I don't know.
To think about these things.
I don't remember. I think it's in the script. I'm going to blame the writer at this point.
No, you can't blame the writer. You can't, because you could have easily...
I could have done something about it.
You could have done something about it and you didn't.
But it's an excuse.
You were just happy for her skirt to melt away.
Gratuitous ass shot.
I do love the ass shot. I'm not saying that shouldn't be
there. I was happy with her. That design of that character
is
good.
She looks great. She is juicy and like fleshy and great.
Right.
I'm super into her.
She's great.
Tanya is a great character.
I like Tanya.
Yep, I like Tanya too. Mm-hmm.
And I like this chandelier made of kerosene lamps. Because I was
nothing dangerous about that.
I was living in Tanzania at the time, and kerosene lamps were a fact of life because the power kept going out. So we had all these kerosene lamps around the house, and I learned how to light kerosene lamps. So this is why this chandelier is made of kerosene lamps.
Oh, wow.
Or paraffin lamps if you're in Britain.
Paraffin, okay.
Kerosene in this country, paraffin in Britain.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
Must be a pain in the ass to light that whole thing.
So that's how we know you're in Tanzania now, is all the kerosene.
Yes, because those lamps are like, were right around the house. We had about five of them.
Okay.
And as soon as the power went out, I had to go around and light them all.
You see. Mood lighting.
Yeah, it's good. Smells bad, though.
Oh, yeah. So, after Dante takes these guys out with the kerosene lamp chandelier... Mm-hmm. He starts making out with Tanya because of course he does.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tanya holds a knife to Dante's neck and reminds him that she could also be after the bounty on his head.
Right.
And she admits that she killed Bartok to get the bar.
Yeah.
So not so much a heart attack as a Tanya attack.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And Dante mentions here that she's a seductress. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a question here.
Yep.
So is seductress just a substitute word for sex worker in future Russia? Indeed. Okay. Because I was wondering if there was like a hierarchy of trained seductresses and like the imperial ones are at the top and like Tanya's down near the bottom.
I mean, there's probably something like fancy, like courtesan is this fancier is what I'm than, saying. Than whore. So yeah, there's a fancier term
We've
for
met
it.
So many sex workers in this story. I just really want to know their backstory in future Russia. I want to know.
I think that was something happens. We could have done. Yeah. I think into if it was a different comic.
Yeah.
We'd had different opportunities. And it was, I mean, 2008 at the time, it was kind of transitioning from being a kid's comic into being an adult comic. See. And it has that awkward kind of like transitional period.
This is we're very not quite adult. Sure. We're adulting
and Dante
right
was
now.
Definitely the forefront of that. Mm. Dante and Slane were doing things that other comics were not doing, you know, or other characters were not doing in 2008 at the time.
Yeah. So, what was Slane doing that was adult?
Shagging.
Oh, shagging. Oh, he got it on.
He was the first character to shag.
Oh, was he?
Yes,
okay.
For sure.
So Dante was like second, sloppy seconds?
I believe so, yeah.
That seems not, fitting for Dante.
Other irregulars out there, please say if you're aware if there's other characters shagging before Slane or Dante, then okay. Let me know.
All right. Dante starts telling Tanya that it's rumored that the reason the bounty's on his head is that he murdered and raped and looted. Mm-hmm. And it says that they say he gunned down soldiers who were begging for surrender, then waded into the corpses and slit the throats of the ones that were still alive. And he burned women and children alive and pissed on them to put out the flames. And he's like, what do you think? Do you think I could do that? And she's just sort of trembling after this speech.
See, this is the kind of...
You're not convincing us, Dante, that you're not a bad guy when you go into
He is a bad guy. He thinks he's a bad guy and he thinks he deserves to die for it.
But he didn't do those things.
Well, he's talking about the rumors. And he knows what he did. And they were bad things, too.
He didn't kill women and children and piss on the ashes.
He killed lots of people, okay? And he killed friends and family members, as far as he's concerned. It's like, it wasn't good. He's not happy. He's had a death wish right now.
Okay.
Kind of, the end of the war is hard on him. Mm. Anyway, this page took a long, long, long time, and I'm still not happy with it.
Really?
It's that, again, coming back
nine
to like
panels
the
here.
Acting, the acting thing, where you want that scene to work, where you've got this, where they go from being flirty and like basically... clawing each other and then to this kind of like she tries to go for him and then the emotional pitch changes to the extent where she's scared of him by the end of it.
Yeah.
That's very hard to pull off and I'm not sure I entirely managed it here and I really wanted to get this to work properly. And
you did all right.
I know. I just feel like I could have done better because I think I probably redrew each of these panels like 7 times.
Wow.
This is the kind of panel that I would really go over again and again and again until I get it right.
Mm.
The complicated ones with all the cityscapes, those don't take me that much time. These ones are people's expressions. They take a long time.
Well.
And I'm not 100% sure about this.
Well, anyway. So she gets scared and Dante then sort of staggers off from her and says, tell them Dante was here. And like standing in her underwear amidst the wreckage, Tanya's like, you think they won't recognize this as where Dante has been?
Right. Hell's Hole Tavern.
Hell's Hole Tavern. Yeah, that's what it's called.
That's what it's called there. And it's a subtle vaginal reference there.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, okay. Very nice. Yeah. On the Owen Hole. Yeah. We like that.
Yeah.
So then the Crest starts talking to Dante and suggesting Dante maybe should keep a lower profile and says that he's boozed, brawled, and womenized, courted trouble with a vengeance since the end of the war. And the Crest starts talking to him about how it's survivor's guilt.
Mm.
And Dante won't hear it. He's shushing the Crest, and suddenly cries of thieves, sinners, and fornicators fill the air. And I love that the Crest is like, they're playing your song, Dante. that's a great line. And Dante rounds a corner to see what the fuss is about and runs into a giant golden church between two like Trajan's columns type things, pillars, with a pulpit in the front from which a rather lovely nun is preaching about how she was saved from a life of wanton sluttery. And we get some amazing lines from the nun here.
Some prime Robbie going on here.
I was touched by the greatest love of all. The holy hand of God now tickles my fancy. I mean, and I love this one. Spurt no more into the black hole of sin. That's fantastic. Truly. Like, bravo. And so repent. And this nun's just like going at it. Yeah. And we see,
or be impaled orally or anally upon red-hot pokers and roasted over the Satan's spit for eternity.
Okay, this episode's just going to have an explicit warning. It's just going to be that way. Also, you had a spelling error here.
What?
On the name of the church.
Church.
You put it as Skopsky. It's Skopz.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Listen.
There's no second K.
It's a translation from the Russian.
Oh, well, all right then. Mm-mm. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. You're no prizing your own thing.
Yeah.
Look,
I completely avoid drawing this crowd. And just, like, looks desultory and crap. Like, garbage.
You mad about that? You mad about what you did with that crowd?
It's a bad page. Panel. It's a bad panel. It's not the worst page, but it's a terrible panel.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right.
Sorry.
So she's basically crying out that everyone needs to surrender their wealth to the church to repent. Mm-hmm. That's always the gig with church, isn't it? Give us your wealth. We'll give you heaven.
That wealth makes you a bad person.
Yes.
Give it to us.
Well, it does kind of make people bad people. I mean, not for nothing. But out in front of the church is a cross-shaped jacuzzi.
Indeed.
Why is it a jacuzzi? That is weird.
The future.
It's pretty cool looking, actually. And folks are being kind of baptized in this thing. Mm-hmm. And Dante jumps in.
Yes.
And emerges with a hallelujah and his hand on the rumps of the nuns standing in the holy jacuzzi. He's seen the light.
Right.
And so the shouty nun takes him to her inner sanctum inside the church.
So to speak.
And Dante grabs her and kisses her. And she ends up kind of fighting the kiss and then melting into the kiss.
Right.
And then knees him in the balls,
mm-hmm.
saying, "I got here first. And is there no honor amongst thieves?" And then this transition is the transition you were going to talk about with the coloring.
Very abrupt shift of color. Well, because Chris Blythe takes over. And Chris Blythe, I think Allison, I don't remember if Allison quit suddenly or we were like, this isn't working out. I don't know. We're still friends, so I don't think it was that bad. But Chris Blythe was the 2000 AD Universal colorist at this point, and he was basically doing pretty much everything. So Chris is a very, very good colorist. He's very competent, very capable. He can do lots of things. The problem I have with what he does is he does lots of things, and I don't necessarily want him to do all the things he's doing. But, you know, it's very professional, very competent. There's a lot of kind of sort of secondary lighting and stuff, which are like, that's not kind of what I wanted. Mm. Anyway. But listen, respect. He's a pro. He knows what he's doing.
So, and we have a tonal shift here, right? Because she's revealed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
She's revealed here because it's the Contessa de Winter. Mm-hmm. She survived the war. Yay.
Mm-hmm.
She's basically pulling back her habit and revealing herself. And I love that behind her, as she's pouring a glass of wine, there's Jesus on a pulpit with like a no smoking sign cross out on his crotch.
Looks like Dante. Actually.
What were you doing back there?
Looks like Dante.
It kind of does look like Dante.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like,
no sex.
What were you doing?
No sex, please.
No sex.
I'm Jesus.
Okay.
No sex, please.
I am Jesus. Do not look directly into my crotch.
Nope. Forget it.
It's like looking at an eclipse.
Yep.
So the Contessa explains how this branch of the church exploited people's fears during wartime and has become the most profitable church going as a result with full papal recognition.
Right.
And after she worked her way through the last heist of Kronstadt's money, she convinced the church that she needed to be saved to try and get her hands on their fortune. She's working on a plan to rob them.
Mm-hmm.
And Dante just kind of inserts himself into the heist to help.
Yes.
And the Contessa is like very happy that he would do so and says, yeah, we'll split it 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
And Dante is understandably suspicious of this.
Right.
We do not have a good record with this woman.
Nope.
But he decides to enlist anyway. And is soon taken through a day at the Skopze Church.
Mm-hmm.
And we see Dante going through the program there, a morning of intense worship, then confession, where the priest has a heart attack in taking Dante's confession. Dante is later hooked up to some iron underwear that shocks him when he thinks of sex. They're called repressor robes.
Yeah. And so we've seen this before.
Yes.
They were repressor. The Skopsky appeared at the House of Sin the first time.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I remember now. Yes, that's right.
So these are recurring characters.
That's right. And we hear, I love the smell of burning pubic hair. It smells like redemption.
Indeed.
Which, you know.
Robert Duvall quote from Apocalypse Now.
Yes, Apocalypse Now.
Of course.
And apparently they use the groin guillotine if the repressor doesn't work. And I want to know, though, if this groin is guillotine. The male repressor, what do they hook up to the women?
Who knows?
Like, what would they hook up to the women? Would it be like an electric tampon?
Possibly.
That sounds possibly horrifying.
Maybe it's horrifying. The whole thing's horrifying.
So, in any event,
it's possibly they don't even think about the women.
They don't even think about the women.
Because churches have traditionally ignored female pleasure. Even in the future,
they just continue to ignore it.
Women don't have sexual pleasure. That's just the weirdest.
Yeah, they talk about male homosexuality in the Bible, but there's nothing said about females. We're going to get to that later. That does pop up in this story.
Doesn't count.
So Dante... Oh, it counts. Dante is, of course, buzzing all day after this is installed. And a group of
All this kind of modeling, all these kind of Eric Rush highlights are kind of breaking up shapes too much, which is what I have problems with.
Yeah.
It's just too much work here.
Mm.
Flatten out, Chris. Flatten out.
Have some faith
in the line work.
So a group of hot nun flagellator enforcers walk by. And Dante's being served by this, like, bountiful serving girl, which, like, why is a serving girl with that much cleavage working in a place like this if they're about chastity, it seems?
Just tortured.
All right. And so Dante throws the chastity buzz belt in the fire, saying no heist is worth this at the end of it. And later he's in the Contessa's chambers, and she and Dante flirt by the fire, and she tells him she's found a way to break into the church vault. As she jumps astride him, she says all she needs is a distraction. And then she calls for the nun flagellators to come save her from Nikolai, trying to ravish her.
Woo-hoo.
So he's...
Nikolai should really know better by now.
He really should. But, I mean, listen. It's the Contessa. She is very lovely.
Fornicating fiend.
Yes, this is what our, nun enforcers say as they come in. And the sexy enforcer nuns come in with electrified whips and they electrocute Dante some more.
As you do.
And I we get another wonderful line from one of these nuns that Dante's buttocks are the hammer that drive his shaft of sin. Really, Robbie's really outdoing himself in this one.
He's been doing the war for so long.
I know. He's like, this is it. It's all built up. Oh, it's my God. All built up.
He's just ejaculating onto the page.
And truly. And it's wonderful. Dante fights the nuns and tries not to let himself enjoy it too much. Mm-hmm. It's a very sexy, kinky fight. And I have to say, Simon, this is your design. Mm-hmm. I love the bike shorts on the nun enforcers.
Mm-hmm.
That is delightful. It's a really funny touch. And it also looks hot in a weird way. So I'm into it.
Don't remember the inspiration for that, but I was into bike shorts at the time.
Because, like, the thing you would think is if you talk about nun enforcers, you would think that are kind of sexy. You would think someone would, like, shorten the skirt or something. But, like, you know, you go for bike shorts, which are, like, you know, obviously utilitarian.
Well, it's bike shorts and jack boots.
I know. Is that a thing?
It is now.
It is now.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. I'm really into it. And
there's something very Germanic about it. I'm not sure why.
It says, ironically, the flagellators were responsible for causing more impure thoughts than they could ever hope to exercise. A quote from the Bare-Assed Messiahs and Father Edward Cayley.
Keeley. Father Edward Cayley. Don't know where that's a reference.
Don't know if that's a reference.
Does sound
something.
Like a reference.
Sounds
or
like a Robbie reference, but you don't know it.
Okay.
Nope. Dante manages to get the upper hand, throwing one nun butt first into the fireplace and knocking the others into a tangle in the Contessa's rather large bed, which, like, that's a big bed for a church concerned about abstinence. But in any event...
We know, people who lead churches aren't necessarily concerned with anything but their own comfort.
There's
a misplaced speech balloon here. The depths of your depravity
I noticed
limits.
That. It's Dante's not saying that, but I was going to say about this panel here... Okay.
The tangle of nuns.
There's a tangle of nuns, and one of the nuns' faces is caught between the legs of her fellow enforcer.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know if that was your gag or Robbie's.
I don't know.
Looks like these nuns are about to engage in some lesbian sex.
I don't remember.
Because I love it.
Yeah.
I just wanted to know if it was you.
Could have been Robbie, could have been me. Don't know.
So Dante then cuts the bedpost off and the canopy from the bed falls onto the two nun enforcers, kind of trapping them there. And the third's ass is on fire from being in the fireplace. So Dante obliges by taking her across his knees and spanking out the fire.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, you know, you could pat a fire out.
I quite like this last panel. I think Chris did a great job with the coloring on this.
We sort of cut to the Contessa happily breaking into
metal,
the church vaults.
Metallic tech things. That really works
just so
well.
So we can describe what the heck you're talking about.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, carry on.
Yes. So the Contessa is breaking into the church vaults.
Indeed.
Okay, and loading up her getaway cruiser with cash. So you're saying, what do you like about the lighting?
I mean, I actually really like the drawing here. I was happy with my little ship here that's kind of loaded up with stuff and the wee robots loading it up. It just happened. I think he did a really good job with the reflected lights and the kind of the metallic sheen on it. It just looks very good. The reference here on the quote is Countess of Crime by Bolivar Degrees. Bolivar Degrees is a reference to the Stainless Steel Rat.
Oh, that was a story.
Slippery Jim Degree. And
you were telling me this was a story you loved when you were a kid. Yeah,
Harry Harrison.
And yeah, yeah.
This is a 2000 AD reference as well, because the Stainless Steel Rat was adapted into 2000 AD by T.B. Grover, it's John Wagner, and Carlos Esquerra.
Wait, T.B. Grover, is that a pen name?
Yes.
Oh.
It was pen name. And Carlos Esquerra. Carlos Esquerra.
Oh.
And it was wonderful, and that's where I learned about the Stainless Steel Rat for the first time.
Oh,
and
then
I
found the books. 2000 AD.
And then I read all the books, and I basically read all Harry Harrison I could find. And that was a big influence.
I still
got
to read those because you said they were so formative. Hysterical. I want to read them.
They're great books. Harry Harrison's a wonderful writer. I love him. Anyway, Bolivar Degrees. James Bolivar Degrees is his name.
Slippery Jim Degree. So Dante then poses as a nun while covering the lower half of his face escape notice, just as the big hunky male flagellators enforcers are about to leave him alone and move on by. Mm-hmm. And I just will say it's nice they have something for the men-loving congregates. They've got these kind of beefy male enforcers as well.
Yep.
To fear and desire.
Big mustaches.
Well, that doesn't code as anything.
Nothing.
And the spanked nun points out that it's Dante, the fiendish sexy Dante, and Dante throws the bare-assed nun into one of the dudes, and fight ensues with the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then their brawling crashes through the doors of the ladies' bathroom.
Steam room or something.
Ladies everywhere, frolicking in states of undress. And I'm just like, did we not think of queer people in this church? Like, they're not supposed to fornicate and all these big, nice pools for women to be naked in together. Surely
women
this
don't have
inspire.
Sex. It's true. Women don't enjoy
women
sex.
Women have no lust when they're alone together.
No, they don't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that ain't true.
Can I just point out my body diversity here?
I'm very pleased with this.
There's a lot of naked ladies.
There's a lot of different
here.
Kinds of ladies in
all
here.
All different shapes.
All different shapes and sizes and ages.
Yeah. And ages, yeah.
There's
old lady there. You can
there's
see
young
lady,
ones and old ones.
Old
and
lady boobs there.
Curvy ones and skinny ones.
It's full on nakedness
you
there.
You do. You've got
full bush.
You've
everything.
Got full muffs on display.
Yeah.
It's amazing this made it into 2000 AD.
Well, the thing
it's
is
like
they're
full
not
frontal
they're not young, sexy women. So, it's,
so nobody
it
notices.
Doesn't count. You're allowed if they're old or older. Or
God.
Bigger, or different
then
shape.
Then it's art.
Then it's art. That's the thing.
You're making a statement.
I'm making a statement.
So, of course, all the male enforcers' crotches start buzzing when they're around all these naked women and incapacitate them.
Yeah.
And so Dante makes his escape looking rather fetching in this nun outfit, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I wrote. He looks rather fetching in this nun outfit.
It's a good habit.
As the women... Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. As the women throw things at him. And I don't know what this is that you had somebody throwing at him. It's weird. It looks like a bladder or something. I don't understand what that is.
I don't know.
You don't even know.
Like sponges or something.
A sponge.
No,
oh, one of those loofah sponges.
Maybe a loofah,
I know what you're
yeah.
talking about.
Maybe
okay.
A it's unclear.
And meanwhile, elsewhere, the Contessa makes good her escape. And Dante defenestrates himself yet again. Crashing out a church window.
And wildly coincidentally lands.
Improbably. Falling and crashing also through the windshield of the Contessa's cruiser that is in mid-flight, flying away.
Yeah.
And
what are the odds, kids?
And the Contessa also says to him, as I wrote down in my notes, that he looks rather fetching in that nun outfit. She says, Dante, you look rather fetching in that outfit. And I thought... Me and the Contessa, we have
so much in common.
We share a dirty brain, clearly.
Clearly.
Which I feel very proud of.
Yes.
And that's it.
And Chris is very good at these reflected lights and the lights off the control panel, lighting up the Contessa's face here. Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Looks great.
So we might do a little editing here, but we are running over an hour for the first time ever.
Oh boy.
So.
Well, it is tightening up. We'll tighten it up.
So in any event, then we are we closing the book? We are closing our book on Dante.
The book on this episode of Dante.
On Dante for today.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll be back next week with the Romanov job.
Yeah.
We hope you enjoyed our podcast. And if so, please subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
Leave us ratings and reviews wherever you can.
Mm-hmm.
And tell your friends. Follow us on Twitter at PodTGDR, if Twitter still exists by the time you hear this episode. Yeah. And you can also find us on Instagram, also at PodTGDR. So you can find us there if Twitter has descended into a fiery wreck by then.
Yeah.
Let us know what you think of the podcast of Dante Comics, whatever is on your mind. I'm Edie.
And I'm Simon.
And we will catch you next time.
Bye.